Chapter 15C, farm subsidies and tariffs. Farm subsidies are fees paid to farmers by the government for two different reasons. First, to buy a farmer's crops at a certain price. And second, to keep farmers from producing certain things. And so let's talk about the first one. Number one, support price policy. Here's how a farm subsidy works. The government might promise, say, let's say you're a wheat farmer, the government says, we don't care what the world price of wheat is going to be next season. We're going to pay you $6 a bushel of wheat as a support price. Now, if the world price goes above $6 a bushel, then the farmer can sell it on the world market or the private market, might get $6.50 or $7 a bushel. If the world price goes down to $5 or $4 a bushel for wheat, the wheat farmer doesn't care because he's got a promise from the United States government that says, we will buy your wheat at $6 a bushel, even though the world price is only $4 a bushel. Well, the farmer says, this is a wonderful deal. This is a great deal. In fact, if I know they're going to buy my wheat at $6 a bushel, I'm going to plant a lot of wheat. And, well, wait a minute. Don't you want to plant some other, wouldn't you want to plant some corn or some rye or some barley or some soybeans or broccoli or carrots or tomatoes or whatever, I don't know. Or let the land be for hay, for cattle, or, raise more cattle. No, says the farmer, I've got this support price. I don't care if people want to eat those other things. I'm going to plant the thing that I have the support price for, so then it kind of guarantees a lot of production. But let's say you get a wonderful season of wheat growing for wheat crops in Canada, in Europe, in Russia, in other countries of the world. And so the world market has lots and lots of wheat, and the price goes down to $4 a bushel because everybody has all the wheat they want. The United States keeps buying this wheat from all these American wheat farmers, and let me tell you, they can grow a lot of wheat. What are they going to do with it? World price is $4. Government buys it for $6. You can't sell it. Well, we put it in storage, in huge grain silos to store it. And that works for a little while, but what happens after a while? It gets moldy, it spoils, it goes bad. So you've got to get rid of it. Ah, solution. Let's dump it on the world market. So we start telling everybody in the world, we'll sell you wheat for $3.50 a bushel. Oh boy, says everybody, we'll buy more wheat than we even thought we were going to buy because the price went down. And so we can sell it at below market price, or we can give it away. Say, here's free wheat to a whole bunch of countries, and it's free food, people will take it. Now, that's interesting. But what happens to the wheat farmer in an African country, say, who has been, he's already been disappointed that the price has dropped to $4 a wheat, a bushel on the world market, and now all of a sudden it's $3.50, and he was going to make just a tiny bit of profit for his family at $4 a bushel, and now the world price is depressed, and he just can't make a living. And so I've had the experience more than once where I've gone to other countries and talked about economic growth and development. And what do people ask me? They say, why does the United States dump this surplus, these surplus commodities, food crops, cereal grains and other things, why does the United States dumping all this on the world market and depressing prices and making it impossible for local farmers to make a living? And I say, I'm sorry, I can't answer the question. I don't agree with the policy either. I can tell you politically why it comes about, but I can't say that I agree with it. Does that make sense? What the situation is now? In any situation like that, there are going to be winners and losers. Who are the winners? First of all, the wheat farmer. The wheat farmer has produced more wheat than the world market would ordinarily want to have produced. But the wheat farmer doesn't care because he's protected whether the wheat price goes up or down. And the American taxpayers have given him a great benefit. So you think, you know what? These poor farmers, these small, just barely making a living American farmers, you know, we need to help them out this way. And this started in the 1930s, this price support program, because during the Great Depression, there were small farms. Farmers were making half the annual income, average income of the rest of the population. Anyway, they were poor. And the government said, we've got to do something. These people are going bankrupt. They're going out of business. We have to help them. And so that was when this program started. And I suppose I can see some benefit for that at the beginning. But now, who is profiting from this? First of all, I've got some figures in here from a Cato Institute study from 2002, and they're mentioning it. Actually, should say the wheat price support goes to households whose average income is 7.5% above the U.S. national average income. It should have been 2000. Of $61,307, allowing for inflation, that would be about $74,000 today, average income. But commercial farms get about half the subsidies, and those average income, those household incomes of large commercial farms are $118,000 or would be about $148,000 today with an average subsidy of $43,000. Who gets this? Some of the farmers who get these support price benefits are Fortune 500 companies, members of Congress, millionaires such as Ted Turner, who suddenly decided there was money to be made in farm price support, so he got some farms. Chevron, John Hancock, Mutual Life Insurance Company, DuPont, and Caterpillar owning these farms that get benefits from this price support program. So, and there's one other winner economically, if you want to think about this. Everybody who likes to eat products made from wheat in other countries, not in the United States, because the price is still held up high at $6 a bushel in the United States, so it doesn't drive down the price for us at all. But other countries, the world market is flooded, and people who like to eat bread or something in other countries, I suppose they benefit somewhat from greater supply and lower price. And bakers in other countries who use a lot of wheat, I guess they would profit. But who are the losers? Well, the U.S. taxpayers. Primarily, they are the losers. That's you and me. Taxpayers have paid the wheat farmer to produce a lot of wheat that the world didn't really want. And another loser, in a small way, but I think it adds up, is anybody who buys any other kind of food product in the grocery store. And this is where it has a result for just your daily grocery bill. If you buy, let's say the farmer just decided to produce more wheat, and so he had to choose to produce less corn or rye or oats or barley or broccoli or beans or tomatoes or peas or whatever else he could have grown on that land. Or maybe he's chosen to raise fewer cattle or sheep or hogs and graze fewer cows for milk. So really, the wheat price support system has distorted the market by making farmers decide to produce less of other food. And that means there is less supply of that other food. And the other things that you buy in the store, whether the beans or carrots or whatever else he might have grown there, those are going to cost a few cents more. Is that making sense? Because he's produced less, there's less supply, so it drives up the price. So you pay more for groceries, not only because you've got a higher price for wheat, but because other products have been produced in smaller demand, smaller quantity, and it drives up the price for other commodities. Maybe just a few cents. But multiply that by 307 million consumers in the United States, a few cents for each other grocery item, and it adds up. In fact, it affects your grocery budget. But the wheat farmer doesn't care because he's made a tidy profit. So here's my summary of the situation. the few profit and the many pay. Is that making sense? That's what I'm driving at in this whole chapter, chapter 15. There's example after example of certain groups, special groups that get special benefits, and they retain their benefits, but everybody else as a country pays. Why? And then there's the other loser, the wheat farmer in other countries. And I mentioned that by really letting the price go below what is he is able to sustain himself by. Now, what's the political reason? If this doesn't make sense, why do we keep this system? Tammy, do you know? Okay. I think this is the reason. Our government, and I think it's a good system, but we have in the U.S. Senate two senators from every state. From states that have high density populations, like the number of New England state or Northeast states, for instance, you get two senators. But you also get two senators from Montana, Wyoming, Kansas, Nebraska. Huge land, not so many people, they still get two senators. These senators from farm states like to get elected. And they like to get reelected. And the farm lobby in those states carries huge clout. Now you would say, okay, so what? Not that many states produce wheat, although a lot of states produce wheat. But here's the catch. It's not only wheat that gets price supports. It's a lot of other crops as well. And so the wheat farmers in Kansas may influence the senators from Kansas to protect price supports, but they can't get enough votes in the Senate to keep it by themselves. But they go talk to the senators from Georgia. And the senators from Georgia say, well, I'll tell you what, we'll vote to keep wheat price supports if you vote to keep price supports for peanuts. Because we grow a lot of peanuts in Georgia. And so all of a sudden, a lot of states have senators that are very susceptible to pressure from farmers, from the farm lobby. Farmers are only 2% of the population of the United States, but because they affect the election of senators, and there are senators from agricultural states, they really have an influence far beyond what their political numbers would demonstrate. So I think, now I love the situation where the United States has two senators from each state. I think it's one of the safeguards that we have against excessive power being concentrated in the federal government or just in large population states. But one consequence is that the small number of people have a big influence on the political process, and the few benefit and the many pay. What does this have to do with biblical principles for government? Romans 13:4 says, the purpose of government is to be God's servant for your good. That is, I think people in authority in government should be thinking, what is best for the nation as a whole? What will do good for the nation as a whole? And to my mind, this system of price supports in general isn't what is doing good for the nation as a whole, because many people are paying and just few are benefiting. So my recommendation is we should, by and large, abolish farm price supports. Now, I grew up in Wisconsin. My father was part owner of a creamery that made butter and powdered milk. And then later they switched and they made cheese and whey powder. And I remember hearing about the milk price support or the support price for milk from early childhood. So I know about this, and I suppose I've benefited from it because my dad's company would be able to figure out what farmers would get for milk. But I still think that the system, when you accumulate a number of crops that are supported this way, that the system probably is best abolished. I think. Do you want to interact on that? Do you want to? Yeah, Sherry?
I agree with you, but I can see as the devil's advocate that massive amounts of productions of one product could promote efficiency of production, which would yield more of the product, and that would be really effective in feeding the hungry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a good question. That's a really hard question.
I'm not for price supports, but I can see that benefit.
But I've got back in my mind a deep conviction that we already have a good system to determine how much of each crop should be produced, and that's called the market. That is, prices rise and fall according to supply and demand that's constantly changing, and those prices give a signal for how much wheat people really want. And we're distorting the market by artificially bringing in all this taxpayer money the government's taking out of my pocket and yours and giving to these farmers. So when you artificially distort the market, you get more wheat and less of other stuff, and not really what people want. Okay, Barry, am I okay on that? Help me. Hold on. Barry, now 10 minutes.
I, too, come from a farm family, and my parents were, and my aunts and uncles, sugar beets. And so here you are, by and large, a family that is Christian and conservative and votes conservative. So I'm for capitalism. I'm for freedom. But when it comes to sugar beet price supports, we'll go ahead and take those. And so my dad and my whole family in Colorado did the same. So I'm for capitalism, but. I'm for capitalism, but. Capitalism is drowning in a sea of buts. Now here's the deal on this. This is a deliberate thing to make government. These people then become addicted to government. See, what government does is localize the benefits. Uh-huh. And diffuses the costs. So why are you all not, when it comes to sugar beet price supports, running to Washington, D.C. and saying, no, we don't want price supports. You don't do that because it only increases your sugar costs $3 or $4 or $5 a year. As if $5 a year is going to make you go to Washington, D.C. and vote against sugar beet price supports. But if you're a sugar farmer, it'll amount to $30, $40, $60, $80,000 a year. So do you think they have some self-interest to go back to Washington, D.C. and say, yes, we want sugar price supports? Of course they do. Localize the benefits, sugar farmers, diffuse the cost to each of us $3 or $4. But the net result of all of this is, guess who sugar farmers vote for? Democrats and liberals, just by and large, they have self-interest to do that. An issue's coming up with collective bargaining and education. Guess where all those union education money, guess who they give to? Oh, really? See, so it's perverted, it's sick, it's sad, but I don't know we have any real solutions to get rid of this, but we must. So thanks. Wayne, when you take all of your horsepower in theology and you're here talking about farm subsidies, I mean, I just sit here in the back row and I say, there's not another man in America that would do this. John Piper wouldn't waste 2 minutes on this subject. John MacArthur wouldn't waste 2 minutes on this subject. And your dear Wayne Grudem does. Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you, Barry. Thank you, Barry. Ron, your own wife, your own very special wife, has her hand in the air. Julie.
Thanks. Would you speak to the issue of how the farm subsidies and price supports actually stabilize the market of the farming community? In other words, without them, you'll have 1 year, you'll have everybody producing wheat. The next year, the prices will plummet. No one will farm wheat, and everyone will produce corn, and we'll have shortages from year to year in certain crops because the farmers are gambling now about what price, which crop is going to yield the greatest price next year. And they'll have a huge decision to make, and they're kind of playing the lottery when they go to planting time.
Keep the microphone there because I'm going to guess at the answer, and then I'm going to have Barry see, tell me if I'm right or not, because he's the expert. Now, there is an answer. I mean, first, I can hear that argument. We need some stability so we can predict what we're going to do. But my answer is, the market is the best decider. And businesses include risk. People get rewards in business by taking risk. And there are some people who are just born for this. They're born for investing, and there's potential for earning a lot of money. There's a potential for losing a lot of money. And some people go into that, and they're called entrepreneurs. Other people don't like that kind of risk, and they're called professors.
A follow-up question.
So anyway, my answer is let the market decide it. And if some farmers go out of business, they're the ones who were the worst at planning, and they were the least efficient farmers. And yeah, some will go out of business, but they should be doing something else.
Can I just ask a follow-up question? But what happens when one year the farmers only produce half the amount of wheat necessary to make bread, and now the entire U.S. is screaming at the government to solve the problem of why is there no bread in the stores because I don't like cornbread.
Right. Then the government says, buy it from Canada. Buy it from Russia. And, you've got to pay $7 a bushel instead of $6 a bushel? Well, okay, we'll live with that. I mean, there is a price for it. And so, but when there's a smaller crop and everybody wants it, the price goes up, and the next year farmers plant more. The price mechanism corrects. It's a constantly, it's every hour, every day, every month, every year, the market, the price mechanism signals how much there is and how much people want. And it magically, wonderfully, I think because God made us to be able to work this way, it adjusts the supply and demand so that the supply ultimately meets the demand all the time because the price adjusts. That's the market. Barry?
That's very good. Now, hedge funds bother me because you're not really dealing in reality. Dealing in something you almost can't find value in, and whereas a futures market in agriculture is the way farmers will hedge against this. So they're constantly in this future market. So they're trying to anticipate those various things. And that's just kind of a way of getting insurance as to big price differentials that can really mess them up. So we already have a mechanism in place. But the sad thing about all of this is this really all turns into crony capitalism. And that's precisely why Latin and South America can't get off on a growth path. South America has been earning about $4,000 to $8,000 or $10,000 per capita per year in all of those Latin American countries, South American countries. They can't break out of this middle income because Latin and South America is crony capitalism. So it's government that gets in bed with the wheat farmers. It's government that gets in bed with the collective bargainers of the teachers' unions, on and on. And so you have that pervasive in those societies, and you don't have the freedom that you need to grow. You won't get the productivity that you need to grow, and so you're by and large stuck. You're stuck. And now understand the essence of politics: divide the wealth, spread it about. Sharing is no sin. When mine runs out, I plan to shout, "Let's divvy up again." Or even better than that, with politicians, their palms are soft, their grip lacks clout. Yet they win votes with each hand out. So here's the deal. So you have President Obama getting in bed with General Electric and Jeff Immelt on General Electric. They go into this together. There's no way that you can rationalize green energy. There's no way that you can make windmills and solar make any sense. Why on wind? Because of wind. It's intermittent. Doesn't blow every day. Trouble. Why solar? Nighttime. Hello? Sun doesn't shine at nighttime. So it's terribly, terribly inefficient. So why do we do it? Government subsidizes it. That's why. And so government subsidizes, and General Electric figures it out and is making billions of dollars on windmills and solar. And Jeff Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, gets appointed as the main consultant to Obama. See how this works? See, this is crony capitalism. And America, by and large, has tried to stay away from this. We've done a pretty good job, but in agriculture, it's an enormous failure. I mean, we started failing on this in the Great Depression, and we continue to fail in this.
Okay. Now, if you think this is bad, wait till point two. Point two is the uncultivated fields policy. And this is just what it sounds like. The uncultivated field policy is paying farmers not to produce certain kinds of crops, but to leave certain fields uncultivated. Why? It goes back to what Julie said. How are you going to keep the price stable so farmers can be sure they can invest in certain crops if it's really high one year and low one year and people are going broke? Well, why don't we just decide that some of the fields that were devoted to wheat or to sugar beets or something, you know what? Why don't we just pay farmers not to farm those lands? And then the farmers that are left, who have a smaller crop, they get higher prices. They're happy. The farmers that got paid to do nothing, they got a good deal. So they're happy. The few benefit and the many lose. So the winners, the farmers who are paid to do nothing and the farmers who get higher prices for their lower amount of crops. But the losers are the rest of the nation and the world because we have less of that crop and higher prices for what we are left to buy. Now, supporters say this is necessary to keep certain kinds of agriculture in the United States. If we didn't keep these prices high artificially by paying some fields to remain empty, then prices would drop so low and there wouldn't be any sugar beet farmers or whatever left in the United States. But I think, again, Romans 13:4, the purpose of the government should be to support the good of the nation in general. And if that's true, then paying farmers to produce nothing on some of their land is completely foolish. The total amount of farm products produced in a year is less because of this policy. How can it make a nation better off when it spends money to get less of something? It makes the nation poorer, not richer overall. And in fact, if some products just aren't made in the United States anymore, I don't know, strawberries or something, blueberries or whatever, they're made in Mexico and Chile, and then we buy them from Mexico and Chile, where we get a lot of our strawberries and blueberries from anyway. Who cares where we get them from? It's still a strawberry. It's still a blueberry. And so the world market will drive some people to produce where they can produce efficiently. And in fact, these uncultivated fields policy go on and on. So you have a farm that was producing, corn, I need a better example. Let's say you've got a farm that was producing peanuts, and then the government said, we'll pay you for this 100 acres not to plant any peanuts this year because we want to keep the peanut price up. And the farmer says, okay, that's great. And then next year we'll do it. And the farmer says, well, you know, we've got an agreement. You've got to still pay me for not producing. Fine. And then a developer comes along and says, we're going to take your peanut farm and build houses there. Oh, great, says the farmer. Thanks, I'll take the cash. You've got my peanut farm. Now the developer sells these houses, and it says, not only do you get this house, but you get $1,300 a year payment for not growing peanuts in your house. Oh, isn't that nice? And there are realtors in subdivisions who advertise that you can get a rebate of so-and-so amount of dollars a year for not growing crops in your backyard, in your suburban home. This is called the wonderfully wise uncultivated fields policy. A surgeon in Houston named Jimmy Frank Howell had so much land that he was growing nothing on that he was earning $490,000 a year for doing nothing on his land and his housing area. That's immoral, says Pammy. Well, These payments now account for nearly half the nation's expanding agricultural subsidy system. What began in the 1930s, I'm reading from an article in the Washington Post, what began in the 1930s as a limited safety net for working farmers has swollen into a far-flung infrastructure of entitlements that has cost $172 billion over the past decade. So, this isn't really God's servant for your good, what government is supposed to be doing. And I'll just tell you the joke that I mentioned last week, where the number of farmers in the United States is decreasing, and the number of employees in the Department of Agriculture is increasing every year. And then there was this Department of Agriculture employee weeping, sobbing at his desk, and somebody came by and said, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" And he said, "My farmer died." I thought it was worth telling that again. Okay, well now, the other thing you've all been waiting for is on the next page, point G, tariffs. Tariffs. A tariff is a fee or a tax imposed on goods when they enter or leave a country, but now I'm going to talk about mainly tariffs that are imposed when goods come into the country. So let's say there's an American tire. What's an American tire company? Uniroyal, is that a?
Goodyear.
Oh, Goodyear. Goodyear is a good American tire company. And they can produce a tire for your, huh?
There are no more.
Aren't there any more? Yes, there are. I think there are because they wanted subsidies. They wanted tariffs last year. Okay.
Goodyear was sold.
Goodyear.
Used to be one anyway.
Firestone. You think there are? No, I think there are tire companies yet. I'm sure there are tire companies yet in the United States. Okay, I'm going to call this the American Tire Company. I don't know. And it can produce a tire for $80. And produce it and sell it for $80 with all the other costs involved and things. And so you go to the, I go to a local Firestone shop there on Raintree and Frank Lloyd Wright in that area. And Thompson Peak. And I see this tire by the American Tire Company for $80. And then I see the exact same tire, the exact specifications, fits my car from the Chinese company, and it's $60. What am I going to do? Well, I'd like to have that $20 to be free to decide what I want to do with the $20. So I'll say, I'll take the Chinese tire. Now, I've got to be sure, there's got to be some standard, some inspection, I've got to be sure it's the same quality. And there might be, you know, if it's $76 versus $80, I might say, oh, I want to buy American. I'll pay a little bit more for supporting a local. But when it gets to be $20 difference in a tire times four tires, whoa, I'm going to buy the cheaper tire. Who is upset about this? Americans, hold it. But I'll tell you, who is especially upset, it's a small, tiny, tiny percentage of Americans. It's people who work in rubber companies in the United States, and the owners of those companies. They're saying, it's not fair. Why, those Chinese factories, they're paying horrible wages and horrible conditions to their laborers. Why are we letting them sell their tires? They say to the government, you ought to put a tariff on those Chinese tires. And the government says, how much? Well, we would suggest $20. Okay, so now I go into the Firestone and I see American tire $80, Chinese tire $80. I'll buy the American tire. That's a tariff. Now what has happened? What has happened is that the cost of tires for me has gone up $20. See, the government thought, well, I'm getting this extra tax money, tariffs, this extra $20, and who's paying it? Well, the tire dealer, the Sears or whoever's selling the tires, and they're paying it. But Sears didn't just pay it out of their pocket. They passed it along to me in a price increase. So a tariff is really a hidden tax that comes out of my pocket when I buy the tire. Is that making sense? The American consumer pays the price of the tariffs through higher prices. So, point C, The many have paid, everybody that goes to Sears to buy a tire, the many have paid to benefit the few. The tire workers and plant owners benefit, but the American economy does not. What happened September 14th of 2009? September 14th of 2009, President Obama announced he was increasing the tariffs on Chinese-made tires to 35% of their price. Who was happy? Unions who had lobbied for this increase and were strong supporters of President Obama. But the process is not limited to tires. Tariffs can spread to all sorts of other goods, multiplying higher prices for everybody. So we put tariffs on tires and this and that and this product. Now what does China do? China says, you're charging $20 extra for tires that are coming into the United States, and our companies are having a hard time selling their tires now in the United States. You know what we're going to do? We're going to charge tariffs on American goods that we import into China. You know those computers you're sending us? You know those bulldozers and tractors you're sending us? Those cars you're sending us? Those airplanes we're buying? We're going to put tariffs on all those things. So now all of a sudden, the Chinese consumers are worse off as well because of reciprocal or retaliatory tariffs. And that cuts into sales of the U.S. company. So tariffs cost consumers hidden money. They take away the $20 of freedom of Americans to spend their money as they wish on this item, this item, this item, this item. The overall result of tariffs on hundreds and thousands of goods is to drive up the prices of everything that you buy if it's imported from other countries. And they prop up higher prices on products made within the country, such as U.S.-made tires. I come back to Romans 13:4. A government that wants to be faithful to the principle of being God's servant for your good, I think, should reduce and eventually eliminate tariffs altogether and bring lower prices and more freedom and more good to the people of a nation. That's why I think free trade agreements are beneficial. Free trade agreement says, we won't put tariffs on your tires. You can build tires cheaper than us? Fine. We'll buy your tires. And what are our tire workers going to do? I grew up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, that had a Uniroyal plant. It had a rubber company where a lot of people work. But what are the people who work in tire companies going to do? They're going to find other jobs where they are better employed. That's the way the economy does. It shifts around. And you say, well, what are those other jobs? I don't know, but they're always going to be there because Americans always find ways to find jobs. We invent new ways of doing things. We invent new careers and new jobs. And people keep on getting jobs. And that's the way the world has cheaper prices and more products. So I like free trade agreements. let's see. Ronald Reagan and George Bush promoted the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement of 1987 and then began pushing for NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, that was negotiated and agreed to by George H.W. Bush and then signed into law by President Bill Clinton with strong Republican support in, 1993. And President Clinton gave China most favored nation trader status in 2000 that gave low tariffs on trade between the U.S. and China. So I think that these are good policies, free trade agreements, because they keep prices down. They help us get cheaper products. And when you get cheaper products, you have more freedom because you can use your money on buying Starbucks coffee if you want to or giving it to Scottsdale Bible Church if you want to or whatever else you want. Policies, give me about 2 minutes. Policies that maintain high tariffs, there's a word for them. They're called protectionist policies because they're trying to protect, say, the tire manufacturers or something like that. In the United States, since the Democrats gained majority in Congress in 2006, the United States has adopted a much more protectionist policy because of the strong support of labor unions that have been opponents in general of free trade. They think free trade will destroy their jobs. So unfortunately, the Bush administration negotiated a free trade agreement with Seoul, Korea, but Congress refused to ratify it. It's a tragic situation where Colombia, one of our best friends in Latin America, Colombia, we had an agreement negotiated with them, and Congress wouldn't ratify it. And so since 2005, around the world, there are 64 new free trade agreements or lower tariff agreements that have been made, 64, and we've only been part of 5 of them, and other nations are dropping their tariffs all over the place, but we keep them high. My conclusion is that countries should move toward abolishing nearly all tariffs on imports. Now, there might be some things that a nation would say, not to protect the special interests, but to protect the culture and the atmosphere of our nation, we might have tariffs. I can see Switzerland putting tariffs on dairy products and cheese because they want to protect their industry, because the cheese industry and the cows in Switzerland are part of the culture and the beauty and the tourism and the way they want to preserve the state. I can see that kind of argument. Or there might be a national defense argument where we would say we have certain things like our armaments that we want to produce in the United States, and we're just not going to have those all produced by foreign countries. I can see that. But there the goal is to protect the nation as a whole, not to protect just special interests. Okay, questions on tariffs. Mike Mobley. I'm always worried when Mike has that little smile on his face. I've got something I missed here.
Again, one of the concerns that I've heard expressed about free trade, and maybe Barry's got some comments about this, is sometimes our companies go into the market and they're really not confronting free trade they're confronting different types of barriers in other markets.
In other countries.
In other countries. For example, I mean, one of the issues is, for instance, Boeing competing against Airbus.
Yep.
And Airbus, in many respects, is being heavily subsidized by governments in Europe.
Yep.
And, you know, and their workers also have free government health care and the things. And so now you've got a situation where Boeing, you know, we endorse free trade, but we've got competition against, you know, other corporations that appears to be very clearly not a free trade or an unfair agreement. And I think, I don't know if you've got some comments on that in terms of those kind of things then seem to have political ramifications, and as people start calling for some renegotiation of trade agreements that way.
Good. When they're competing against an unfairly government-subsidized industry trying to sell airplanes, the answer is negotiate. That is, negotiate with European countries that are supporting Airbus. So say, okay, you want some of our goods, we want some of your goods, let's see if we can come to an agreement. And there are these World Trade Organization rounds of negotiations where people come to agreement, and then, of course, there's all the litigation back and forth to say, have you broken it or not? But in general, I think countries can reach, or should at least be encouraged to reach, good agreements on these things. Now, in fact, Mike, I've read that the company, I tried to find it last night real quickly, and I couldn't find it, but I've read previously that the company in the United States, for dollar value, the single largest exporter in the United States is Boeing. That is, they sell more dollars of exports to other countries than any other country. And then way up there are Caterpillar, John Deere, and some of our high-tech computer manufacturers and pharmaceutical manufacturers. So we export huge amounts of things. But yes, I think that is an argument. But I don't think the argument should be, okay, then we're going to put tariffs back on their airplanes. I think it should be, see if we can negotiate and move toward free trade. Carol?
I grew up on a farm, and both my grandparents had farms. And I can remember being at my grandparents when they were talking about farms having. They just got notice that they had to leave their land idle. I mean, my grandfather, I'd never seen him so upset.
Why? They had to leave it idle?
Yeah, they could not. They were ordered not to grow crops.
Because of this idle fields. Oh,
exactly.
Wow. Yeah.
And how it affected our families, it was really memorable. But I want to get the point across of, we used to depend on the Lord for whether our crops would be good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
Some years we'd have too much rain, other years would be dry. And if we had needs, we would families and neighbors, mm-hmm. or families in the church, we would help one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so sad now that the government mm-hmm. has taken over everything in our world.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah. it upsets me to know.
Wow. Thanks, Carol. Thanks. Good. Yeah.
Since we're off on that farm thing again, I am an evil wheat farmer.
Uh-oh.
And it's my ox here that we're goring.
Okay.
And let me say that it isn't as liberal as you make out anymore.
Okay, okay.
Because one of the things I have to do is certify that I make less than $500,000 a year farming, and also that my total income is less than $750,000. So these big, rich farmers are not getting subsidized.
Hmm. Tell me your name.
Jim.
Elliot. Jim. Okay, Jim. Go ahead and say more if you want, because I don't like it when I present only one side and don't hear another side. So I really want you to be able to...
Well, we could have a debate on this whole thing.
Okay.
You know, it cost me almost $4 to raise a
bushel. Yeah.
So if I don't get $5-6, then I don't make any money.
Yeah, yeah. So you are saying we should have some kind of price support still?
I think that it brings some stability to the farming. Because otherwise, we'd have a pretty small bunch of farmers.
Would anybody stay in farming if we didn't have price supports?
Well, yeah, the big farmers would, I think, mm-hmm. because they can be spread out. But weather is a big element of farming, especially if you're a dry land farmer like me.
Yeah.
If I don't get rain, I don't get a crop.
Yeah.
So, and in many of the areas now, you can't drill a well for irrigation. You can't in Kansas. There's no more wells in Kansas because they're losing, the water table's going down so fast.
Oh, boy.
So we got to do something.
Okay. I hear you saying for stability and in order to keep some farmers in this situation, in the business, you've got to have some kind of price supports.
For the small farmer.
For the small farmer, yeah. Okay, I'm just going to let that... Thanks. Good. Yeah. What else? Oh, Bill, up here in front.
Just, one thing that you haven't commented on, you or perhaps Barry, there is this huge bureaucracy that's administering the farm programs. Poor
yep.
people all be out of work if you do what you say.
Yes, I know.
But in addition to that, right now, farm commodity prices are substantially above support levels.
Ah.
And one of the reasons is that instead of, let's say, corn going to produce corn flakes or wheat going to produce bread, there are long lines of trucks lined up at ethanol plants.
Yeah.
And the ethanol industry, would it exist if it weren't for the government's involvement? And what's the impact of that direction on food commodity prices in the world or on commodity prices here?
Yeah. You're right, Bill. Because of a lot of corn especially going to ethanol production, it wouldn't be economical because it's more expensive to run your car on a gallon of gas than a gallon of ethanol or a mixture. It wouldn't be economical except the government gives subsidies to ethanol.
Right, right.
Huge amounts of subsidies. And then the farmers who are growing the corn for ethanol say, wow, I've got another good deal here. It's the second verse of the same song. And so then they plant a lot of corn, but then that all goes to ethanol, and then there's less corn to eat. And all of a sudden, the price goes up. And the world price of corn, it's really hurt Latin America
right.
a lot, where people are subsistence-level poorer people, and they depend on the world price of corn, and their price goes up 50%, 70%, 80%. All of a sudden, that's a huge hit to them, and it harms them. But that's another government intrusion and
sure.
distorting the market.
Instead of drilling for oil
yep.
or supporting
yep.
coal
yep.
or developing nuclear energy,
yep.
we're
yep.
forcing the
yep.
ethanol situation
yep.
for political purposes.
Yep. And unfortunately, the early primaries in the presidential primaries are in Iowa. And ethanol is a big deal in Iowa. So, okay. So, you know, I should say, I talked about President Obama signing these increased tariffs on tires. President Bush, George Bush, you know, I liked a lot of what he did, but I did not agree that he allowed and signed tariffs on steel. First year of his term, and I am afraid it was a political consideration because of steel worker votes in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. So it's not that either party is guiltless on this. Okay, yep. What's your name?
John Rogers.
John.
I've spent my life in North Dakota. I grew up on a farm and,
okay.
and worked in that environment. Two observations. One is on the CRP program, setting aside farmland.
Yep.
The farmers are smart enough not to set aside their productive land. They put their very marginally productive land into CRP, and because it's much more profitable
yep.
for the government to pay on that. So
yep.
the amount of production taken out, I think, is very questionable. And the other side of things, I found it very interesting that small business owners would tolerate the government insuring small farmers or inefficient farmers to stay in business when they are not being supported and free enterprise takes its toll. If they're not efficient managers, their business won't survive.
Mm-hmm.
But the programs the government has for the farmers ensures that even marginally efficient farmers can survive. I found it interesting that small businesses would tolerate
But you're saying if we didn't have these support systems, the people who would go out of business would be the least efficient farmers
yeah. that really would be better doing something
yeah.
with their time
yeah.
in some
yeah.
other...
Yeah, I think so, because not everybody would go out of business. We'd still have farms.
It sends yeah. them a false signal of,
okay.
of efficiency.
Yep. Okay, John, thank you. Okay. Song time. One more minute. Let me see. Anybody else? Yeah. Okay, we got okay. one or two. Well, I've got time. Yeah, go ahead. We got a short song.
Doug Mergenthaler.
Yep.
Maybe this is for Barry or for Wayne. I don't know which. But concerning tariffs and China,
yep.
where China is manipulating their currency,
yep.
how does that affect the tariff situation?
I don't know. Honestly. Barry, you want to say something?
You know what? Really, I don't think we'll talk about Africa in 2 weeks. Scratch Africa. I tell you, this subject that we're talking about is absolutely critical. And I'll say two things. One is, Wayne, because everybody so respects who you are, they're just not going to take you on this one. But... people don't respect me like that, and so they just beat my face in. This is the most misunderstood economic law that there possibly is on free trade. And there would be a lot of people that would really have liked to disagree with you. Unfortunately for them, and fortunately for you, Wayne, you're dead right on this. So why don't we pick this up and try to take this step by step and see if we can't get to an understanding. Because if we have brothers and sisters in Christ who love each other, if we can't come to the understanding, you almost see the impossibility of the task. But the inclination of most Americans is it's just got to be right to buy American. That's just got to be right, etc. And it's just a total misunderstanding of free trade.
Well, Barry, okay. This is why we call these enrichment classes. This is enriching our understanding of how the world works. I saw one more hand back here, but I'm a minute over. Is this going to be really quick?
Yeah.
Really quick. What's your name?
I want to hear a little more about these jobs for the
What other jobs to tire? Okay, here's my question. It used to be how many people worked? 65% of the population worked in farming, Barry, and... A century ago? 60 million. All right, but 50 or 60% of the population was in farming? And now it's 2.5%. So what did those other people do? Are 55 million farmers just sitting around saying, we don't have anything to do, I guess the government has to support us? No, they all found other jobs. They're in high-tech industries. They're in other kinds of manufacturing industries. They're in retail trade. They're also... Yeah, so we decline in manufacturers. But what we do is, Americans are smart. We think of new ways to... We think of, oh, maybe people would like to pay $5 for a cup of coffee. We'll start a company called Starbucks and see. And so all of a sudden, we have... The human wants will never be satisfied. And so the opportunity for people to design and build new companies, new products to satisfy those human wants is never going to end. And that's where the jobs come from.